Welcome to Thinking Aloud, a podcast about the nexus of politics and all those things that make us human. From the Lindenwood University College of Arts and Humanities, I'm your host, Don Heidenreich. 2 decades into the 21st century, it's clear this century will be defined by the relationship that a growing China has with the United States and the rest of the world. China's economic and military growth has given it power and status that has led to both influence and conflict around the globe. It is difficult for nations to respond to China's policies without knowing both where they came from and where China is going. To enlighten us on this topic, my guests today are Dr. Brian Arndt and Dr. Dale Walden of the Lindenwood University International Relations Program. Dr. Arndt is an expert on China, and Dr. Walden is an expert on foreign policy and global strategies. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe it's best to, in a sense, work backwards and to start with where China is today and how it got here, but also then to even look at the deeper, bigger picture. And on that question, Dr. Arndt, where has China come from to be where it's at in the current world?
Well, that is a long story. Most people from China will tell you, if you ask, China is some 5,000 years old. Archaeologists and historians are not quite agreed on China being that old. However, what we do know is that while starting off relatively small, by the time we move into the, let's say, about 1000 AD, the Chinese economy was the largest in the world. I don't think any historian of world history could dispute that. And during the late 1400s, China actually built a huge navy. This navy was sent out to explore much of Asia. The purpose behind this was mostly diplomatic, but also to establish trade ties as well. Well, China slipped in terms of the size of its navy. It became a little bit more of a regional power, but the Chinese economy remained the world's dominant. There's not much doubt about that. And by the time we get into the 1700s, the Europeans were actually looking to China as a possible model of government, probably you've all heard of, Confucius. Confucius and the followers of Confucius suggested that his methods of serving government and of the monarch serving the people was the best way to run a country. There was no religion in it. And therefore, a lot of thinkers in the 18th century thought this was the best way to run civilizations. China slipped. By the time we get into the 1800s, the European industrialization, the European investment in worldwide trade, the advances in naval technology allowed the British to defeat the Chinese Navy. By the time we get into the 1900s, China was a minor power, and it had slipped economically compared to the rest of the world. Now let's go forward. As we go into the first half of the 20th century, China is not a minor world power. It still has, of course, a very large population. Its industry is relatively limited. Of course, it faces a massive problem when the Japanese invade in 1937. After that war was over, came a civil war. So China went through a series of crises. Its economy lay in ruins, population devastated by World War II. Then came the Communist Party of China, and Mao Zedong decided to rebuild China through the ideology of Marxism. Of course, we're talking about communism here. Somewhat successful, China was unified under Mao, but the Chinese culture, believe it or not, was kind of affected in the long run negatively by this. China, though, was not much of an economic or world power until the 1980s, when the new chairman of the Chinese Communist Party, Deng Xiaoping, decided that certain steps had to be taken in order to open China up to the world, modernize it, and allow its economy to flourish. He was successful. By the 1990s, China was a leading economic power. It was the world's manufacturer. Its army and navy were relatively small and limited. By the early 2000s, though, the Chinese government, after 9/11 especially, realized that China could have a terrorist problem because of its Islamic population, particularly in the Northwest. China then began a policy of modernizing its military to make it better able to deal with small threats as opposed to very large ones. But when Xi Jinping came into power in the early 2000s afterwards, he and, it appears, a cohort of individual leaders in the Communist Party of China, which really runs the government, made the determination that China needed to become a world power, not just a regional power. This meant constructing a large navy, which Xi's government is in the process of doing, and a large and capable air force. And now China is looking into cyber warfare. So China is no longer, as it was in much of the 20th century, a relatively minor regional power. And now it is trying to step onto the world stage.
Dr. Walton, how does this all play out in some of the bigger issues that are currently going on today?
I think there's a lot that really traces back to China's transformation when you look at the international system as a whole. You see, in the 1990s, the United States as being what's often called a unipolar power, that it was by far the greatest power in the world. No one was even close in terms of overall national power. And China at that point, and I remember well when people in the American foreign policy establishment were rather dismissive of China. They would talk about it as a regional power, still very poor, all those sorts of things. But then China's economic transformation combined with political events within China, particularly after Xi Jinping came to power and reoriented Chinese foreign policy along the lines that my colleague was talking about, that then you are now seeing China, I believe, bidding to be the world's greatest power. They see a United States that's in retreat and disarray in a lot of ways, that domestically is in complete upheaval. And I think that Xi Jinping intends in the next, whatever his time frame is in his own mind, you know, 10 years, 20 years, to move China into the position of being the predominant world power. I suspect that will involve at some point a confrontation over Taiwan. How that might unfold, though, could be any of a thousand different scenarios.
So on that note, what about Taiwan? How important is it to China? Is it one of those things that might be used as a way to, as the Russians used to do, divert public attention? Or is it something that is really of great serious concern to them?
Well, the issue between China and Taiwan is pretty old. Let me take a look at it if I can digress a little bit. Taiwan has been a part of China and has not throughout history. It was originally settled by Polynesians, as you know, settled Hawaii and some of the Pacific Islands. I mean, it's not really until the 1400s that Chinese settlers arrived in Taiwan. Chinese government at that time and succeeding governments looked upon Taiwan as peripheral, for sure. Attempts to govern it with the Chinese magistrates, with Chinese governors, was pretty limited. The people of Taiwan, certainly the Chinese settlers, were simply there because they ran out of room. Mainland China, they were simply trying to live a more prosperous life all on their own. The central parts of Taiwan were not even really settled, left to the aboriginals. Now, as we move into the 1800s, we have a major incident take place in 1894-95, in which the Japanese go to war with China, defeat China in depth, and as the terms of the peace treaty, decide to take Taiwan. The Taiwanese had actually declared themselves independent at that point, but the Japanese came in and essentially suppressed any desires of the Taiwanese to gain their independence. And from 1895 to 1945, Taiwan was a part of Japan. It's one of Japan's leading colonies. It was very good for Japan because of its agricultural output and because of its willingness, basically, to be part of Japan, sort of. After 1945, we got a problem because people don't realize this most of the time. There are actually two governments of China to this day. There is the People's Republic of China, which governs all of China, and there's the Republic of China, which governs only Taiwan. So we have two legitimate governments. The Chinese Communist Party, Chinese government, rejects the idea that the Republic of China governs Taiwan. They feel that Taiwan, as a matter of fact, an inherent part of China. In the past, the Chinese Communist government, beginning in the 1980s, thought they could persuade Taiwan to rejoin China by using the example of Hong Kong. Well, that example was reasonable, but not much anymore. So What about nationalism? Chinese nationalism started in the 1920s, really, and then gained ground after that. The Chinese communists used nationalism during the 1950s to oppose the United States. Now, today. Well, today, Xi Jinping's government sees nationalism as a foundational element in its control over the Chinese people. We've probably maybe heard of social capital, that kind of statement, that kind of approach. And so, by encouraging the Chinese people to support China's claim to Taiwan, and by building that large navy I mentioned earlier, it appears as if Taiwan is under direct threat. And so we, the Chinese people, must unify. We must unite in order to make sure that the Republic of China doesn't conquer China. That's a ludicrous proposition. But you know, what matters in history? What's really going on or what people think is going on?
That's always a significant question. What about China in its efforts in the South China Sea?
Well, that is really an interesting and troubling story, because what China decided to do in recent years, really, and this is a long-standing dispute, where several powers have claims in the South China Sea. And for a long time, and both Chinese governments have made very assertive claims in the South China Sea, but none of this really came to a head during the Cold War era for a variety of reasons. And in the post-Cold War era, I suspect that these competing claims could have been worked out, but they weren't during that time frame in the 90s and the early 2000s, when perhaps they could have been. And it has now become a major pillar of Chinese policy. And at this point, I believe that the Chinese government has probably, the Communist Party, has so leaned into this policy of claiming almost the entirety of the South China Sea that I don't know that they could really easily step away from it even if they wanted to. And they don't want to because they are thinking particularly about a potential future naval war. And they really want control of the South China Sea to keep the Americans away from the southern coastline of China. So I think for them, it has become a major national policy. It went from being something that was almost an afterthought to being something that's become rather an obsession.
Now, what about the other countries, though, that are in the South China Sea?
They don't like this at all.
No, that's certainly true. Believe it or not, the Vietnamese are the ones who are most nervous. They have some claims in the South China Sea, and they have they've had some incidents where the Chinese Coast Guard, now Chinese Coast Guard is not the U.S. Coast Guard. The U.S. Coast Guard really only patrols the coastline of the United States, and we know the Coast Guard of the United States mostly for rescuing capsized boats. But the Chinese Coast Guard is actually a part of the Chinese Navy. And in that particular case, Vietnam has confronted the Chinese Coast Guard. There have been some incidents I mentioned. And what's more, Vietnam is nervous about its northern border with China. Others, Philippines have claims, so the Philippines are concerned. But the Filipino president seems to be a little more friendly, although he's on his way out, so we'll see there. Indonesia has some claims. The Indonesians are at the far south of the South China Sea, so their claims are kind of limited. Singapore has claims, as does Malaysia and Thailand.
China has a long history on its border with India. How does that play into the particular interests both of India and in China?
Well, yes. That border in the past, if we want to jump back a couple of centuries or so, was not really terribly important whatsoever. China didn't even reach that border really until 1949, when it became the central government. Previously, that border was under the control of the Tibetan Kingdom. So it wasn't even part of China, not China's concern. But in the 1950s, the Chinese government took over Tibet. It was a self-autonomous province, admittedly, but for all intents and purposes, the Chinese ran it. And it's then that they stationed troops along that border. That border was not well marked out. And so by the time we get to 1962, tensions started to rise between India and China. India was on the path to a much more fully functioning democracy. It was industrializing, but China was on its way to industrializing as well, and the two got into a border conflict in 1962. From then on, it's been a bit of a sore spot with incidents occurring here and there. Recently, though, we've had at least one minor military confrontation, and we've seen the Chinese shift their armies around and start to establish forward bases. And that has concerned India. And by proxy, it's concerned the United States now, because the United States is interested in a full-fledged alliance with India.
How has Pakistan been responding to all of this?
Well, Pakistan has been friendly toward China for quite a while, a number of decades. And Pakistan increasingly is perhaps an ally of China in all but name. And so tensions between China and India are not necessarily a negative from a Pakistani perspective, because that will further cement, I would suspect Islamabad hopes, will further cement the relationship between China and Pakistan. And especially now that Afghanistan has transformed to a Taliban government, where Pakistan can be expected to have a great deal of influence, that I would say that if you look at things from a Pakistani perspective, then there has been a lot of strategically positive movement in recent months.
So do you expect the relationship with China to be strengthened between Pakistan and China?
Yes, I absolutely do. It's a major recipient of Belt and Road aid. The Belt and Road Initiative that China is using to expand its influence and trade network is putting a lot of money into Pakistan and building highways, port facilities, stuff like that. And that is intended to further cement that relationship.
Can you expand on the Belt and Road Initiative? What exactly is China trying to do, and where is it trying to do it?
Well, increasingly, it's trying to do it pretty much everywhere, outside the New World. They haven't yet expanded there. But the Belt and Road Initiative is this very expensive, very large effort by China to really make itself the clear center of trade in Eurasia and Africa. And so the Belt and Road Initiative is intended to run all the way into Europe itself, to Central
Italy.
Europe, all along the east coast of Africa, southern coast of Asia. It really an effort by China to use its power as a trading partner and as a provider of aid to then leverage that and bring countries into its orbit in a less direct way than the Americans did at the end of World War II. You know, at the end of World War II, the United States really had a security-led sort of offer, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Are you worried about a communist takeover? Come see us. Here, the Chinese aren't leading with security. They're leading with just establishing and improving trade relationships. Paying for infrastructure with, providing loans where the recipient country will get infrastructure that in most cases it very much needs. There are questions about how predatory some of those loans might be by the Chinese government.
Well, first of all, the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, originally appeared to have been a way in which China could assert its influence over Central Asia, the former Soviet republics, because those Soviet republics needed developmental aid, and the Chinese, of course, being a neighbor, decided to provide it. For centuries, Russia had been the premier power in that part of the world. The Chinese may have, to some extent, although some of this is a little bit murky, looking to supplant some of Russia's influence there. And by providing roads, literally, this is where the road initiative comes in, and railroad service, the plan was to at least run as far as Moscow and into Eastern Europe for this railroad that was under construction. The Russians were not necessarily happy. They didn't necessarily want China. By the way, there is a history of rivalry between China and Russia. However, the Chinese are working on it. And then there's also a sea line of all this thing, a southern line by sea. And this involves the acquisition of port facilities in the Indian Ocean, where the Chinese hope to expand their merchant ship facilities. But even more so, Loans to Sri Lanka, for example, were a little bit questionable because those loans were paid for the reconstruction expansion of a port in Trincomalee, which is the one of the ports in Sri Lanka, which some analysts suggested would make a great base for the Chinese Navy. And likewise in Eritrea, I believe it is. So it may be a long-term military and security strategy. What seems to be going on is that China is trying to protect lucrative trade, but even more so the resource of oil. China is extremely petroleum poor, and it's been importing oil from the Middle East in larger and larger amounts as China begins to develop and the Chinese begin to drive more cars. And the only route for oil to reach China is through that South China Sea we talked about. And therefore, protecting that South China Sea seems to perhaps be the goal of acquiring port facilities in the Indian Ocean.
So if the question becomes trade, and if that's really the major concern, then is a possible conflict with the United States over Taiwan really in the Chinese interests?
I think that the answer to that is probably not in the interest of the Communist Party over the longer term, because once, if they successfully take Taiwan, they then have to rule it. And I'm not sure that, I think it's over 20 million, the population of Taiwan, that those folks are really going to be willing to accept the sort of absolute, increasingly totalitarian system that Xi Jinping is creating for China. And so I think that the Chinese likely would be buying themselves a very difficult insurgency. But as for whether it would be in their shorter term interest, it could be. At this point, based on various war games that the U.S. has done and other sort of indications, it's very possible that if there were a war tomorrow over the South China Sea, that the United States would lose.
Now, the question I'm thinking, though, is that even though the Chinese might win, is it possible they could end up losing, not just because of the issues inside Taiwan, but literally because of trade around the world? You're going to have a response from the United States, you'll have a response from the Europeans. The Russians and the Japanese may not particularly be very happy about it. So is it really worth the potential economic impact in order to gain physical control of Taiwan?
We may be past that point in that the world is already moving beyond the neoliberal paradigm of the 1990s and early 21st century, that we are seeing a reshoring of industries around the world. We are seeing a great deal of anger at China over questions about the origin of the coronavirus and possible massive Chinese deception in that regard. So all of those things together, and China's very assertive and sometimes aggressive attitude toward neighbors, you add all that together and China already has a substantial problem. And so I think that we may be at the point now where Xi Jinping is maybe saying to himself he's not worried so much about trade implications and that kind of thing, because that is going in another direction anyway. And you can see that in the United States, you can see that in Europe. So that axe hanging over Beijing's head may be looking more and more blunt.
Yes, and I'd have to add, first of all, that one of the things we do have to understand is that the Chinese government is largely dominated by one political party, the Chinese Communist Party, and the leadership is composed of only maybe a dozen people, mostly men. The point here is that they play their cards very close to the chest. The Chinese thinking and strategies are largely a black box of sorts because there are few defectors. Because even social media is largely under control of the central party, there are leaks that come out. For example, what's happening in the northwest part of China to the Uyghur population was leaked. That's how we know much of it. So in our terms to get specific about what we think is happening in China's foreign policy, we have to sort of read between the lines. Now, the question remains as to whether she had this plan in the beginning of his term as president. Was he trying to at least take Taiwan, if not fend off the United States when it came to the South China Seas? So we have to look at the Chinese behavior and patterns, and that appears to be an indication that we may be looking to a serious confrontation. But I will add that China's not in a box of its own, because the United States has allies in the region. The Japanese, Taiwan, of course, I mentioned, the Philippines, which are in and out, Singapore, very strong ally. So how would the allies react? One of the indications of this is that the British have sent a major task force, aircraft carriers and ships, to the Pacific. The Australians have building up their navy, at least to some extent. Recently, the Germans sent a frigate to this area. So are we looking at some form of a coalition rising to deal with this increase in Chinese assertion?
And how might the Chinese respond to the new and possible alliance?
Well, that's a good question. This is what China has faced after the triumph of the Communist Party in 1949, because right away, China was a pariah in international relations. The war in Korea, in which the Chinese actually fought the United States, meant that the United States would not harbor any possibility of diplomatic recognition. Western countries were a little bit lukewarm on this one, but it was clear that China was not to be dealt with. It was to be put aside. The Chinese felt themselves completely isolated. They were surrounded by hostile countries, hostile alliances. We're not exactly sure how to characterize the response, but it turned inward. And during the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s, a lot of people died internally in China in order to what the Communist Party said was to transform the Chinese people into good socialist men and women and to make sure that there were no traitors around. That was severe. We're not even today sure how many millions died in that particular incident. So will it happen again? We've seen indications that Xi Jinping wants to crack down on religion. Now, the most famous part of this is the Uyghur Muslim minority, but there are Muslim minorities throughout China, and we've seen Christian churches being closed, as well as the one small part of China, which is predominantly Jewish Chinese. So we are seeing a culture war emerge, too. Now, is that due to the fact that the Western countries seem to be forming this alliance? Or is this an attempt to find internal enemies that one can point to the Chinese people? They are a danger, and we're going to suppress them.
And one thing that I would note in relation to that is I think the Cultural Revolution is really underestimated on part of most American news reports and even in the foreign policy establishment as a very significant event. This was a massive national trauma that went on for a decade. And so, and this was one that followed previous traumas, such as the ones that my colleague was just talking about, as well as stuff like the Great Leap Forward, in which perhaps 70 million people starved to death. So you add all of that together, and Chinese society has been transformed from what it was in, say, the late 1940s in very fundamental ways, and we don't really have a good handle on what those are. In many ways, the Chinese themselves don't have a good handle on that, I suspect. So all of that adds up, in my mind, to a very sort of combustible public opinion that has been guided by the state to be very nationalistic, very aggressive, which, ironically, now that China has tried to goad an entire generation, actually a couple generations now, with a sort of hyper-nationalist rhetoric, it would be very difficult for them to turn that off in some ways.
Well, thank you very much. This has been very enlightening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week. Thank you for listening.